Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. I ate one of the season's fresh figs the other day and remembered why life is beautiful. A fresh fig is a thing of wonder. We'll talk about how to eat them fresh and cooked and then learn a little about their past. Figs are so good, they make you want to sing. We'll talk about that too. So let's dig in. Julie O'Hara is a freelance writer and recipe developer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and blogs at A Mingling of Tastes. She has written about the virtues of the fresh fig for Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Figs have two seasons, don't they?
Yes, they do. The first one starts in mid-May and lasts till early July. And that comes from the previous year's growth on the fig trees. And then the second season is a larger harvest, and it starts in August and lasts through the fall.
Do they taste different?
No, they don't. It's just, it's kind of comes down to how they get shipped to supermarkets, and, you know, it explains why you'll see a bunch of figs early in the summer, and then you won't see them for a couple months, and then they're back. But I haven't been able to tell a difference.
There are a number of different kind of figs. What are the ones we see most commonly in the supermarket?
Most commonly, well, at least for me here in Florida, I see the Black Mission fig. And all these figs come from California. California produces 98% of our fresh figs. And I think the classic fig that you might picture if you know what a fresh fig looks like is the Black Mission fig. It has a dark skin and a deep pink interior. And that's my favorite fig. I just like the flavor. I think it's a good balance between sweetness with a little bit of acidity. And then you'll also see the brown turkey fig. I don't think it's as beautiful as the Black Mission fig, but it's the most widely grown fresh fig in California. And it also tastes sweet and delicious. And then you'll get some green figs. The Calimurna is a fig from Turkey. And it's a cross between the Smyrna fig, which was grown in Turkey and brought over to California, so they named it the Calimurna. And it's also very sweet. All figs are sweet. And it has a large, round, green fig. And then Codota is the fourth main variety. And it's a smaller green fig, and it's also used for drying. A lot of the fig paste that gets turned into fig Newtons would be from Codota figs. But it's very sweet and very delicious, too.
When you mentioned fig Newtons, Saraya Mohammed, who is our producer, said she doesn't really like figs because of fig Newtons. Now, what do you have to say to her, Julie?
I've heard that before, and I totally understand. The funny thing with fresh figs is getting over your expectations, because we've all had those fig Newtons, and they're not that great, you know? I totally understand. But you just have to try to wipe the slate clean and get a perfect, juicy fig. It should be soft and kind of heavy for its size, and maybe even, you know, a little bit of juice is coming out of the bottom of the sides of the fig. And taste that fig, and it's nothing like those cookies. It might have a shade of that fig flavor that you would recognize, but otherwise, in my mind, it's a completely different food. And there's so many things you can do with it. You'll forget about fig Newtons once you really get into fresh figs.
Okay, good. She'll have to give it a try. Now, tell us, you really write quite an ode to the fresh fig for Kitchen Window Online. Tell us why you are so taken with the fresh fig.
I'll explain it this way. I'm not the kind of person who would say, oh, all I need in life is a perfect peach, and that's better than any dessert, any chocolate cake. I'm not that person. I like sweets. I like sugar. I like chocolate. I like desserts. But you give me a fig, and all that other stuff goes out the window. Somehow the fig transcends the sweet, delicious quality of other fruits. It's candy-like, but it does have a little natural acidity, so it's not pure sugar. And it's the texture. It has this lush texture. It just melts in your mouth, and I just don't think that can be replicated by the greatest pastry chef, the most fabulous decadent dessert. It's just a perfect natural food. So that's all I can say.
You also feel, though, that they are good cooked, right?
I do. I really do. And, you know, figs come from California, you know, for the most part. And so they're getting shipped across the country. I'm in Florida. So if you get a fig that's not necessarily perfect, you can cook with it. You can roast it, and that will bring out its jammy sweetness. And so I do a kebab with figs, roasting them. They're great in salads. You know, combine it with vinegar and oil and cheeses. You know, all those savory foods, you get the contrast between sweet and savory and salty and sweet. That's a great way to eat figs. Like, I love pairing a fig with salty feta cheese. That's my favorite way, and I think it's fabulous.
What other cheeses are good with figs?
Oh, absolutely a blue cheese, like Stilton or Gorgonzola. That's a lot of people's favorite, and that is also a very salty cheese. I like hard cheeses. Goat cheese is nice. It's a little mild. Really, I think any cheese you like, but I'd stick with the hard cheeses.
And figs are used in both sweet and savory foods.
Yeah, they are often. And I think that's because they pair so well with salty things. Like, you'll see figs wrapped in bacon or wrapped in prosciutto. That's fabulous. I love figs on pizza. And you pair that with prosciutto, some cheese, maybe some basil or arugula. That makes a great dish.
Figs seem to be gaining tremendously in popularity. I don't think I've gone to a dinner party recently where fresh figs weren't the appetizer.
You know, you might get sick of them, but that's such a great thing to hear. And it's true that for the past 5 years, sales have increased by 30% every year. I've learned this from the Fig Advisory Board. And it's great, and that's because the growers out in California are realizing that they can make more money on fresh figs than just by selling the dried figs to food manufacturers. And people are responding to this food, and I can see why. It's something new, and, you know, we don't get a lot of new fruits, you know, in the world just showing up.
Well,
you know,
it's new, except it's incredibly old.
It is, and that's really amazing. It's one of California's oldest crops, and the first fig tree was planted there in 1759, but it's even more ancient than that. Figs are mentioned in, you know, ancient writings by, you know, Greek and Roman philosophers. They're mentioned as a source for health and even as an aphrodisiac. Think of, you know, Adam and Eve in the Bible covering themselves with fig leaves.
Right.
So,
right. Now, what about storing figs? How long do they last? They're quite delicate, aren't they?
They're very delicate. So you would want to store them if you're going to eat them right away, and you should eat them as quickly as possible, especially if they're very soft and juicy. You should just eat them. But they will ripen on the counter over the course of 2 or 3 days. And if they're ripe, you want to keep them in the refrigerator. They have a tendency to turn moldy if there's too much moisture, so keep them on paper towels and spread out. Don't bunch them together. Maybe they'll bruise if you do that. So in the fridge, they'll keep for about 5 days, but anything beyond that, you might want to cook them, and you could turn them into a jam if they're overripe or underripe.
How do you store them in the refrigerator?
Oh, I would spread them out on a paper towel, maybe in a shallow Tupperware container. You would want to take them out of their little plastic crates because they're too close together in the crates. So take them out of there and spread them out on a paper towel.
Have you ever frozen figs?
I personally haven't, but you can. I just read about this too. You would want to spread them out on a baking sheet so they're not touching. Freeze them on that baking sheet, and then you can put them into a Ziploc container. You know, they can be close together, and they'll keep for about 6 months. So you can have them all year.
That's wonderful. There are also all sorts of fig spreads now, you see. Fig conserves, fig jams.
Right.
Is that part of the whole new interest in figs?
I think so, for sure. It's one of those new flavors that's just the trend has, you know, taken into huge proportions, and it's great, and I hope it continues. But yeah, the preserves are wonderful with cheese. You could top fresh baked brie with a fig preserve, and that would make a fabulous hors d'oeuvre. Mm. I also do a quick fig jam with maybe figs that are, you know, kind of blemished figs or underripe figs, and you just simmer it up with a little bit of sugar in a saucepan, and maybe a quarter cup of sugar for a pound of figs. And you've got a quick jam that you can just keep in the fridge for a week and eat it.
Wonderful. And at Christmas, you will no doubt be having a figgy pudding.
A figgy pudding. I have to try it just because, but I never have yet. So we'll see.
All right. Julie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was food writer Julie O'Hara. A discovery in Israel suggested that it was a fruit that ended human rootlessness. And that fruit was the fig. From 2006, NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Hunting and gathering for a living isn't much fun. Long commutes for those hunters to find game. Same for those who have to gather those acorns and wild oats. Thankfully, people in what is now the Middle East and Turkey figured out that if you collected seed from wheat or barley and planted it in the ground, you could kick back and eat out of your own backyard. But now archaeologists in Israel have discovered something they didn't expect, 11,400-year-old figs in an excavated house. And not just any figs, mutant figs. This fig is an accident of nature, a rare kind of tree that isn't pollinated by insects and won't reproduce unless someone takes a cutting and plants it. But it does grow soft and tasty figs rather than the unpalatable wild kind. According to Harvard anthropologist Ofer Bar-Yosef, generations of people must have lived around wild fig trees until the Newtonian moment when someone figured out how to grow these mutants.
It's generally women who do the gathering in hunting and gathering societies. And, you know, years of experience would tell them exactly how the plants behave and so on. With the figs, it's very easy because you just need to cut the branches and just stick them into the ground.
The evidence for this conclusion is a handful, quite literally, of dried mutant figs found in a village called Gilgal, not far from Jericho. The figs were in a house where there'd been a fire.
And maybe they were all the remains of what used to be some kind of a domestic storage, you know, baskets hanging from the ceiling in order to avoid the mice get to them and so on. And the whole thing just collapsed on the floor.
Writing in the journal Science, Bar-Yosef and colleagues in Israel say these figs may now be the first cultivated crops, centuries before the first farmers planted cereal grains. But he suspects the transition to domesticated crops, whether it was barley, oats, or figs, was a slow process.
The fact that the figs were already domesticated means that humans were enjoying this practice of cutting branches and sticking them into the ground to be the new trees. You don't get plants like figs domesticated if you don't start planting it systematically again and again.
Since these were small, tightly knit communities, once one person figured it out, well, the fig doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Not surprisingly, figs even have a place in grand opera. Food historian Francine Segan has written a book about musical meals called The Opera Lover's Cookbook. She pairs recipes and menus with arias and overtures. The treat sold by street vendors in Puccini's La Bohème, for example, inspired a fig and nut recipe. For Falstaff, fig and prosciutto penne. NPR's Jackie Lydon talked to Segan in 2006.
I'm Italian-American, and my grandmother, who was the matriarch of the family, always played opera in the background. It was one of those very typical Italian-American families where on Sunday, my grandmother would prepare food for all her children and all her children's children. I mean, this Sunday food thing was like a five-day-a-week sort of event. It started Tuesday. She'd prepare for the Sunday. So it was every week. And she'd be playing music. And so that was a big start. And I think a big reason why I kind of always associated opera and food, although Italians kind of associate food with everything.
Well, the Met has opened its fall season with Madame Butterfly and Anthony Minghella's production. And we are going to ask you to cook for us from your cookbook some of your Puccini-inspired recipes.
It's going to be my pleasure.
Okay, let's cook.
Okay. Thank you. And in fact, the coincidence is I'm going to see it tonight. Jackie, would you like an apron or would you like a smock?
Either one.
So this recipe that we're going to make is a pasta dish for Il Trittico, Puccini's 3 one-act operas, and it's got 3 main ingredients, and that's it. Apricots, oranges, and almonds. And it will be cooked before the pasta boils.
Wow.
The sauce
that's
will
incredible.
Be cooked. So what I'm going to do, since it's so quick, is I'm going to show you one of my tricks.
Okay.
What I like to do is divide up the water. So I put some water in a tea kettle.
Okay. Which, of course, goes very quickly.
And then just some water in the pot. And then by the time that's boiling, my sauce will be ready. Now, what I'm doing is putting on gloves because I'm going to see the opera tonight, and I don't want to smell of onions. And these are wonderful little surgical gloves that I get in a big, big box. 1,000 for like $8. So just take a nice purple onion, and I'm slicing it, and we're going to saute it in a frying pan with a little bit of butter and a drop of oil. Il Trittico is 3 one-act operas, which are loosely tied together. I saw a connection. Just like with this dish, the base is an onion, and you sort of get teary with an onion. And the base of all those 3 one-act plays has a sadness, has a death. And so it kind of just made me remember this dish, the 3 main ingredients, the kind of starting out with the onions, the teariness, but yet sweet and wonderful at the end. And then the other 2 main ingredients, really simple, are just some apricots.
Dried
and you
apricots.
Can use dried, mm-hmm. or you can use fresh if they're in season. Mm-hmm. So we've got some wonderful red onion, which adds a nice color to this dish. You're going to see the beautiful red onion and then the pretty oranges of the apricots and of the candied orange peel. And then all we do is just bring this to a nice caramelized sort of mushiness.
Now you're cutting up candied orange peel.
I'm cutting candied orange peel to add a little bit of crunchy sweetness. Then I want to keep with the flavors of the orange. And so I want to add just a little Cointreau, which is an orange liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine if it catches fire. It just means that the, because you'll burn off the alcohol like this just right now.
And I should say you added your Cointreau with quite a flourish. And there's probably...
Yes. I think I'd like even more.
A half a cup of that.
A half a cup of Cointreau. Mm-hmm. And now we'll add a little bit of fresh orange juice. And your sauce is done.
Wow, fantastic.
Just turn it off. Pasta is ready. Now we do is just drain it and then toss it with that simple, simple sauce. And then the fun is just the last little few things that we top it with. We're going to put nice almonds and then we'll put shaved Parmesan, which I'm just using a vegetable peeler. And then I just need that nutmeg grater, if you don't mind. And we put a little bit of freshly grated nutmeg, which just falls down like this lovely light snow. Since we might as well gild a little.
Oh, yeah.
Just a little bit of zest. Now we're done.
That's
our Il Trittico pasta.
Well, we better eat while it's hot.
Buon appetito.
This is heavenly. Grazie, grazie, grazie so much for having us here today.
Thank you for coming and enjoying.
Francine Segan, author of Opera Lover's Cookbook.
That was NPR's Jackie Leiden. For an encore, some further thoughts on the symbiosis of opera and food. I have no scientific proof, but even without a double-blind, placebo-tested trial, I firmly believe that people who love opera love food. Opera lovers are passionate people of lusty appetite. They celebrate excess. They rejoice in the intense, the transcendent. After all, as humorist Robert Benchley said, opera is where a guy gets stabbed in the back, and instead of dying, he sings. For good measure, a stricken tenor might very well hoist a glass of wine in one hand and brandish a leg of lamb in the other. The entire second act of La Bohème takes place at a sidewalk cafe where starving artists sing about love while ordering lobster. Mimi, already not feeling so well, just has the custard. Hansel and Gretel, of course, has a witch's cottage made of cake, sugar, and candy. Rossini's passion for food rivaled his passion for music. One of his best friends was culinary guru Antonin Carême. The story goes that Carême would send Rossini a pâté, and Rossini would write him an aria. Rossini quit writing operas at age 37, giving himself more time to eat. Ever heard of Tournedos Rossini? For a diva, as well as a composer, the sure sign of success is to have a dish named after you. Australian soprano Nellie Melba lived at London's Savoy Hotel in the 1890s when singing at Covent Garden. Auguste Escoffier, maybe the greatest chef who ever lived, ran the Savoy's kitchen. He was as avid about opera as he was about food and created two dishes in the singer's honor. Peach Melba, poached peach halves, vanilla ice cream, and raspberry sauce, and yes, of course, Melba toast. Chicken tetrazzini, with its rich sherry cheese cream sauce, was created in the early 1900s by an American chef in honor of Italian singer Luisa Tetrazzini. Today, Renee Fleming is the reigning diva at the Metropolitan Opera. She has sold 2 million CDs and won a Grammy. But the clearest indication of Fleming's stardom came when New York celebrity chef Daniel Boulud created, in her honor, a chocolate and hazelnut dessert with the first page of an opera score laser printed on top. So, whether we talk about opera or about food, we're talking about passion and nourishment for both the body and the spirit. To me, the connection is obvious. Now, somebody should do a study. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.